Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and onto changes in society and the world. My name's Andy Pollane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, coach, trainer, and writer. Power of 10 is also about interesting people and their journeys into design. Today's interesting person is Katja Forbes, Managing Director of Design at Australia and New Zealand. Katja is also on the global board of the Interaction Design Association. Back in 2014, Katja founded SIFT, or SIFTE, a specialist business in research and experience design. And then in late 2018, her business was acquired by international firm Wipro, and she was announced as Managing Director of Australia and New Zealand for Design It. Katja, welcome to Power of 10.
Oh, thank you so much. I love getting introduced. It always just makes me feel so special and accomplished.
So did I get SIFTE right?
SIFTE, yeah, it's actually, that's pretty good. So SIFTE is a Swedish word. It means purpose. I was looking for a good name for my company and trying to find something that resonated with me personally, I guess, in looking at my heritage, which is Scandinavian.
Right.
The word I really wanted, which is a Finnish word, sissu, which sort of means strength and gumption, but of a very female variety. Sissu is, that's a great Finnish word. However, it is a great Finnish word, and so a lot of organizations had already kind of claimed it. So I went hunting for something else and came up with SIFTE, which is purpose, and it was a purposeful business, and so it seemed the right one to go with.
Right. We were just talking before that that sissu probably wouldn't have gone down so well in Australia. It would have been size you.
Oh, God. Look, Australians, this is a gross generalization, but Australians have a lot of trouble pronouncing anything complicated. I speak of lived experience here. My name is Katja, okay? Now, there were no other Katjas in my school when I was growing up. There was no other Katjas that I knew. And so my name just got completely brutalized by all of my school friends. And so, you know, I feel like I kind of even brought it on myself again, choosing a little bit of a difficult company name. SIFTE's not like straightforward. So yes, it's a more, difficult choice, I guess, to go with something that is non-English first. However, it spoke to what I was trying to do. So I'm good with that.
That's good. And well, now, is the name retired now?
The name is retired. It is retired. And because SIFTE became Design It Australia and New Zealand. And so as part of that, it was an acquisition of humans and contracts and assets and things like that. But it was not an acquisition of the brand, because the Design It brand is actually super strong already, particularly in the Scandinavian countries.
Global, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, there was no need for them to acquire an Australian brand. They needed the place to stand up Design It Australia and New Zealand, and we were that place.
Great. So I was trying to think when we met, and I think we might have met just as you had founded SIFTE, I think in around 2014, maybe at UX Australia or something. Mm. That's where I think you might have met.
I remember. No, I met you in a workshop that you were giving at UX Australia.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was at UX Australia.
Yes.
So I reckon that might have been around then. I'd have to go and look back at the dates. So I don't know, maybe you hadn't quite started it then. Tell me a little bit about your journey, because, the last... what, sort of 6 years of it have been pretty steep, meteoric rise into leadership. But tell me about how you sort of got to the point where you thought, I'm going to start my own company.
I spent some time, I spent 10 years in London, first of all, working for all sorts of different organizations, starting with Sapient, which taught me how to be a consultant, an experience that I wouldn't trade for anything. I learned so much in that organization, the 5 years that I worked with them. And then I worked a little bit client side in places like Yahoo, Thomson Reuters, and then coming back to Australia, found myself literally going back in time, because London was so far ahead in terms of design practice at that time. We're talking 2010. And so I came back to Australia and found that I was having to have conversations that, such as I would have never have had when I was in the UK, particularly around inclusion and accessibility and just basic fundamental digital access for people with a disability. This was all new. It was super new in Australia at the time. And I came back here and didn't quite know where to land. I didn't know anybody anymore. 10 years away from the country where you grew up is a long time. Had a lot of trouble fitting in. All of my friends from school had gone on and had kids and were doing things that I couldn't relate to anymore. And so I found the easiest way to try and find my feet was to jump into some freelancing. And so that's what I did. And I freelanced for a few agencies here. And then, like, you know, all good freelancers ended up at a bank. Australia is very strong in its design practice in our financial services sector. And I was lucky enough to start out at one of the strongest now, the Commonwealth Bank, and worked there for a number of years as a freelancer, and kind of got to the end of wanting to work on just one project or just one product or just one industry sector. And so left that consultancy gig and started up my first business with a business partner. And we tried to make a go of inclusive design as a practice. But I think we went a little bit too early. And so it wasn't the raging success that we'd hoped it would be. And now I watch in awe as organizations like Intopia here in Australia are ragingly successful in having inclusion and accessibility as their practice and making a business out of it. So I learned some really good lessons in starting that business. And then after that business wasn't as successful as I hoped, I went back to Commonwealth Bank and just thought, I'll just sit here and breathe for a bit and figure out what I'm going to do. And landing in my lap at that time was one of the largest and most challenging contextual inquiry projects that I had ever been offered. And it was to go and have a look about how all staff in Commonwealth Bank used their CRM technology. And I was like, all the staff? And they're like, yeah, all the staff. We want you to go and look at all 18 departments. And I was like, whoa, can I get some people to help me with that? Because that's a pretty big job. And also maybe can I go and get my own people? Because I've got some really good people I think who'd be great to work on this. Mm. Bank's like, yeah, sure, that's fine. But you have to be a Pty Ltd, so an incorporated company. Otherwise, we'll get superannuation liability. And I was like, oh, okay. So I started my company. Not every origin story is sexy and amazing. Mine started with trying to avoid superannuation liability.
But, you know, someone else's avoidance is your gain then.
And it was an amazing project. We did 107 observations of people doing work all over Australia. It was fascinating. Mm. And then they said, oh, could you have a look at this for us as well? And I was like, oh, I'll have to get another person. Could you have a look at this too? Yeah, absolutely. But I'll need to get another person. And then I had 7 people working for me. And I was like, ooh, I probably should get another client if I want to keep this company sustainable. Yeah. So all of it was kind of happy accident, hard graft as well, and opportunity being in the right place at the right time with the right people. I actually employed a number of people straight out of General Assembly who were transitioning from their current jobs in, you know, working for Accenture as business intelligence analysts and reskilling themselves in user experience design, and gave them their first shot out of that. And I'm so proud of that crew of people and where they are now. One's at Google, you know, they've dispersed themselves all around, you know, different parts of the design practice in Australia. And I'm super proud that I was able to give them their start. My favorite thing is offering people a job. As a business owner, that's one of the most gratifying things I think you can do, which is create jobs for people, create work for people, facilitate spaces for great work to get done. I mean, I've been off the tools for some time now. I wouldn't ask me to design anything because I literally have been away from the hands-on practice for such a long time that I think there's better people to do it. But I know that I'm very capable of creating a great space for work to get done that's of terrific quality, and for people to learn, and for people to really, you know, stretch into different parts of our craft and our practice.
So let's talk about that, because there's two strands there which I'm imagining have sort of woven together as part of your DNA as a leader. And one is, you know, you mentioned before that your time at Sapient taught you to be a consultant, because there's definitely, I mean, you were kind of very self-aware of, you know, we were a bit too early for the accessibility and inclusive design and so forth. There's a, you know, being able to speak the right language and tell the story and the narrative of what you're trying to sell ultimately, but actually the kind of change you're trying to create to people who may be needing that change, who may be probably not ready for that change, is a large part of it. And then the other side is the people skills. I know you've spent a lot of time, when you said you're off the tools, I was thinking, well, maybe you've just kind of zoomed up a level in the sense that your interest in people and how people tick and how they use their tools and form part of the role of being a leader and setting up an organization and maintaining that culture. How much of that sort of resonates with you? Is that a kind of fair summary of it? And which bits do you kind of really lean on a lot?
I think the zoom out aspect of it absolutely resonates. I would say that I've done a bit of leadership training, and something from that leadership training, which I have absolutely used in my practice of those abilities, is the concept of being, you know, up on the balcony or down on the dance floor and leading from the balcony strategically, you know, working on the business rather than being down on the dance floor and being in the business. Mm. There's points in time where, you know, as a leader, you do have to get down on the dance floor and boogie because people, you know, stuff goes wrong. People need you. People need you to escalate to and also sometimes, you know, hold their hands as they get through difficult stuff. But the concept of being zoomed out, I absolutely do resonate with that. But I call it being up on the balcony and, you know, taking that bird's eye strategic view of what's going on and what people are up to and how things are going.
So I'm interested in what that transition was like for you. I wrote this piece a little while ago and it's something that sort of a lot of people come to me for coaching about the sort of design leadership dip, which is this moment where you're kind of starting to let go of your tools and your kind of skill in those, which is often part of your identity very much as a person and certainly professionally. And then you're sort of moving into this leadership role and you're not quite so good at that either. So there's this kind of dip in the middle where you're sort of a bit rubbish at both for a while. And for some people, it's a real existential crisis. For other people, sort of sink a little bit and then swim and fly. How was it for you, that journey?
I feel like I'm of the school of, so long as I'm one page ahead of everybody else and they don't know that it's only one page that I'm ahead, I'm good. I've got it.
I can tell you've been a teacher.
Yes, I have. Yes, that is very true. I have taught design both at General Assembly and at University of Sydney. But I'm also a very, I don't need a lot of preparation, I don't think. And I think it just comes from so many public speaking engagements, so many talks, so many presentations, so many leading of workshops, so many being up and facilitating. And I've had this conversation with Steve Beattie, actually, about, conversation / disagreement, about, you know, what are we as design practitioners now? Because I find in my practice and directly, you know, contributing to my transition to leadership, that facilitation and the ability to get people to listen and talk and get to consensus and align and you know, get shared understanding through creating artifacts or whiteboard, whatever that is, whatever that facilitation looks like. I really feel like that is a very important part of the role that we do as design leaders and also design practitioners, you know. I know that Steve's point of view on that is more like, well, why did we go to design school if all we do is facilitation? And I think that there's different parts of the craft that kind of come together there. There's the hands-on part of the craft. There's the creating the design magic part of the craft. There's the understanding humans part of the craft. There's the creating tangible artifacts so that we can all move forward and create something and put the rubber on the road. But I think that facilitation is absolutely a part of the craft and a very important part of it as well. Wow. What we do... Yeah. It might not seem, you know, esoteric to us, but it's esoteric to a lot of people. They don't understand how we work through the design practice to get to solving problems and coming up with different ways of doing things and new approaches and things like that. And it's a bit of a mystery magic black box for a lot of people who don't spend their day-to-day in the kinds of problems and spaces that we do as design practitioners. So our job and where facilitation really comes in there is demystifying all the stuff that's in that magic black box and helping people use the tools of design to solve their problem, not kind of keeping it as this is my special magic bag of tricks and you don't get to play with it unless you hire me and pay me a whole lot of money. And then when I'm finished, I'll pack all my tricks back up in my bag and I'll take it away and all the value will walk out the door with me.
Yeah.
So I think that in that transition, taking the, say, more practitioner level running of workshops, presenting my designs, defending my designs. I've had meetings in the banks where I've sat with a committee of 20 people going through my wireframes one by one, button by button, you know, interaction by interaction, going, why did you do it like that? And being able to facilitate that group of people through to consensus that I do know what I'm doing and I have done it the right way. And taking that sort of lower, more junior practice through facilitation, through to, you know, public speaking and presentation, that's been instrumental in my ability to be a good leader. Because if you can't tell your own story and tell the stories about the things that matter and that are important, well, nobody's going to buy anything you're selling. Doesn't matter how good it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I noticed LinkedIn is asking me what your top skill is. And one of the options is wireframing here. So I shall I'll click on that.
I'm terrible at that.
LinkedIn's so random. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the, you know, there's another thing I wrote, which is that I kind of realized that with my coaches looking about saying about how do I manage stakeholders, how do I do this, is, and also how to manage a studio and a group of designers. It's slow motion facilitation, right? The same thing you'd do in a kind of week, in a day or 2 days, is kind of stretches over weeks and months and years. In terms of, you know, we talked about inclusive design right at the beginning of, you know, who's being included and excluded, which is something you're kind of very acutely aware of in a room, at least. It's harder on Zoom, but in a room of, you know, of people, you literally see some people sitting off to the side. You see someone where there's a table where there's a group of people and there's one person who, for whatever reason, isn't involved. Right? It's very visible. And I think part of the role of leadership in design is kind of trying to have that same view of, well, maybe it's looking from the balcony. I have that same view of, you know, who's dancing together, who's standing at the wall, who's kind of sitting on their own in the corner, right?
Yeah, how can we get the sense of belonging for everybody when everybody is so completely diverse and from different backgrounds and therefore different lived experiences? And that is definitely the case.
So I love metaphors, and sometimes they keep giving and giving, and sometimes they break. So let's try this one, though, which is, you know, with the dance floor metaphor. You know, it's very hard to get everyone dancing all the time. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, there are certain tracks when the alcohol level is kind of high enough, which gets sort of, maybe everyone dancing. But in general, you know, people who've got different styles of music that they like, and they'll ask the DJ for different things, and half the dance floor leaves and the other half comes on. In your design practice, you know, in the studio, when you're managing that, how do you kind of make sure there's music for everyone?
That involves a lot of listening, active listening, to the people who make up our design studio family. And this is glib, I know, but designers have a lot of feelings. As a group of people, we have a lot of feelings, and not in any way, shape or form ever dissuaded from feeling all the feelings and sharing all the feelings. So there's kind of a consistent active listening mode that what I find that I need to be in order to make sure that everyone feels like they are heard and included. I think for us, we're sort of centering around particular values that resonate for us at a local level. I mean, design, it has a set of global values and things like that, and all of those are worthy. But there are some things that resonate more for us at a local level, and, you know, some songs that we like to play more than others. For us, we are incredibly passionate about sustainability by design. I know that if I bring a sustainability-based project into our studio, everyone will get up and dance. Everyone. And so being cognizant of what people individually value and what we value collectively really helps to get that great, I guess, participation from everybody in the studio work and in wanting to move the studio forward. And we do a lot of introspection as well. I mean, at the moment, because, you know, COVID has helped us with our, you know, time to introspect. due to our pillar client, Qantas, no longer requiring our services. Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, we have had some really good time to be introspective about our practice and how we run as a studio and how we operate as a group of people. And the design directors in the solitary design director I have, he has been instrumental, as well as our leads, in creating operating models for our studio around values and making sure that people are always working towards what they might have indicated is interesting for them in their own personal development. So we have very strong talent development practices within Design It that are set up to ensure that people are paying attention to their development, that us as leaders are paying attention to development as well, and that we're trying to foster work in the studio that is going to contribute to it and also contribute to the things that we value. So that would be my answer for that one. Aligning it around values is how we get everybody up and dancing.
Yeah. But it's often quite hard to, the values, or even coming up with the values is often the easy bit, right? They're kind of...
Super difficult to get it right though. Super difficult. I mean, yeah, we still haven't got it right, but we're still trying.
But also keeping it alive and keeping it intact in the face of all the other pressures is really hard. So, in what way can you talk about the ways you kind of make that sort of quite tangible and in terms of people's lived everyday experience of, I was going to say going to work, but you remember when we used to go to work, of turning up on Zoom or Teams?
Yeah, I think for us, we've used the time that we have had available to us to really immerse into some pro bono work, finding things, or people actually seek us out. They seek me out and I say, can I pick your brains? And this is one of my leadership tips. So when people ask to pick your brains, if you want to remain accessible, that's fine. But if you want to protect your most valuable commodity, which is your time, choose 1 hour a week that is available for brain picking and say, this is the time that is available for brain picking. You can do it at this time or not at all. And if they're serious about actually engaging and getting advice or information from you, they'll make the time and they'll make it at the time that suits you. So I have people coming to me saying, could I get some ideas from you about this pro bono project or this thing that I'm doing, or, coming in that sort of approach. And if I think that it's something that my team is going to be interested in, I'll take it to them and say, we've got some capacity. This person is asking for this. Is there someone who's interested in taking it forward? And we've got a project that we're just kicking off with an organization called Artists Against Poverty, who have been very disrupted by COVID because they generally have done their fundraising, which delivers outcomes for women in Indonesia through microfinancing. And they've been very disrupted because their fundraising has been events-based. Come to our exhibition, buy the art that you see at the exhibition. Right. So we're helping them through that disruption. And there's also the ability for my crew to bring to the table pro bono work that they would like to have us consider. And then we'll go through, we'll consider the merits of it, we'll see what we might be able to do to help them, we'll get approval on spending things for free, and then, either take the project forward or not. And I think allowing for those kinds of social benefit interactions and social benefit projects, and also, they don't all have to come through me, they can come through the team as well. I think that one is definitely a contributor to our, our overall studio vibe and people feeling like they are more than slamming together a bunch of wireframes for an insurance claim process. That said, Andy, there is also value and social benefit to be found in very unassuming design practices. Because if you want to make the day better for someone who needs to put in an insurance claim because their house was burned down, and this is really the worst day ever, and your insurance claim process is really frictionless and you made their day, but that matters. There's something in that that's super unassuming and super small and will never ever make it to the front of the Guardian, but it matters. And I think there's that detail practice that can be very socially beneficial.
Which is the answer to Steve Beattie's question, actually, I think that, yes, design has become more and more about facilitation, particularly on a strategic level. I mean, there's so much in kind of what you've just said. Part of it is, I think, yes, designers maybe wear their kind of feelings on their sleeve a little bit more than other people in sort of corporate business environments. I don't think it's true that designers have more feelings than anyone else, right? And I think one of the things that has we always need to remember is that everyone has feelings. And, you know, a lot of the pressures that often come from, you know, high up execs and C-suite is not coming from a place of heartlessness. It's actually, a lot of it's coming from anxiety and fear, right? That drives a lot of the kind of stuff. And as a hence, the need to facilitate that and understand what's driving this behavior that I'm perceiving as negative, and how there's something around the communications of what we're doing that's making this person feel uneasy and anxious, and therefore they're starting to sort of grip tighter and actually kind of make it worse. So there's a kind of bit about that I think is really crucial, where it's some of the tools that you use and the lens through which you kind of view people as a designer are very, very helpful in that leadership role and in kind of talking to stakeholders and the rest of it. And then down the other end, I'm really glad you said that, because I think I know we're talking about leadership quite a lot, but it also gets quite fetishized in the sense that there's sometimes just fixing an everyday annoyance for someone, you know, and it can be quite small. You know, the corner of the thing that you constantly catch your hip on every time you walk past, that kind of thing grinds people down. And especially, you started off talking about your experience with CommBank and the kind of employee experience with enterprise software, which is, you know, legendary for being awful.
Oh, God, the stuff that I saw out in the field.
Yeah, right. And so you fix pains. Some of those things, and you really do make, you know, and you aggregate the kind of effect of that. You make people's lives better, you make everyone work a bit better, and over the kind of thousands of people who work with that stuff, you know, it actually has a kind of big payoff. So, you know, I think that to answer this, go back to Steve's question, I think that's the two levels of Zoom that I would talk about, kind of, because I'm obsessed by levels of Zoom, which is that the details affect the big picture and the big picture affect the details, and you need to be able to kind of go between the two.
Agreed.
You are also a well-known and much fated face in, you know, your top 100 Australian professionals, 2020, top 10 Australian women entrepreneurs by My Entrepreneur magazine, one of 100 women of influence named by Westpac and also the Australian Financial Review. So there's a lot been around you as a leader and a lot around you as an entrepreneur and a woman in leadership. You know, I coach a lot of women in leadership too. I'm interested in what your experience has been. You know, I saw a slight kind of eye roll as I was reading that kind of stuff out from your bio, and we talked about it a bit before. It's always weird kind of reading your own bio and thinking, I'm not that person.
Yeah, I do feel like they're talking about someone else.
So, well, let's talk about this. Imposter syndrome, or as it's originally known as an imposter phenomenon, actually the original researcher who looked into it, which I much prefer because it sounds like a thing that comes and goes rather than an affliction for life. Mm. How much have you been cognizant of being a woman in leadership in this role? And then how much has that been sort of made evident to you by maybe some of the clients or stakeholders? Or how much has it been something that you've thought, it doesn't really play a role, it's just a kind of happenstance of who I am?
It absolutely plays a role. I mean, when I was listed as one of the 100 women of influence in 2016, my initial reaction was, well, they must not have had enough women apply.
Right.
I didn't understand how I was worthy of getting on that list. And if you look at some of the women who were also on that list that year, you know, Dr. Karen Phelps, you know, Gina Reinhardt, I think, was on that list that year. But I felt like an absolute imposter. And literally, I did think they just must not have had enough women like that year. They must have been desperate to include me. So that imposter syndrome, it's definitely valid, and it has afflicted me to some degree. I think I'm better now. I think I have a better sense of my worth, a better sense of my value, I guess, and confidence in my ability. I think I've gone, you know, as we've talked about, sort of a very meteoric rise into leadership. It was at sort of, I don't know, a 40-degree angle while I was running SIFT and doing my own thing as a sole director for a small company in Australia. And then I joined Design It, which is a global organization, and it has gone to, like, I'm almost at like 85 degrees of going up in terms of things that I'm learning, opportunities I'm being given. And I think that has actually, the last 2 years, I've learned more about what I'm capable of than I think in the majority of the rest of my career, my previous career. Being a woman in leadership is, I don't know, I was watching Jane Caro last night on Q&A in Australia, which is an Australian Current Affairs, where they have, you know, notables talking about politics and things like that. And Jane Caro is a commentator, particularly on women's role in society and how, you know, they are either advantaged or not. And her diatribe last night was literal fury about the situation that many older women in Australia are now finding themselves in terms of being truly poor in their old age due to how they've been affected by COVID, looking down the barrel of homelessness.
And superannuation inequity, right?
Exactly. Superannuation inequity because, you know, you take the departure from work if you choose to have a family, or you may take a departure from work and therefore your superannuation is always going to be less than your male counterparts.
And you get paid less, so you're starting,
You know, all of the things, Andy, all of the things.
Yes.
And so as a woman in leadership and as a woman just, you know, traversing the world, my belief is the standard that you walk past is the standard you accept, which is the Chief of Army's statement. And, you know, I'll call it out. I'll call bullshit on sexism. I'll call bullshit on bad behavior. I will do it. But let me tell you, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. Personally, and, you know, women friends that I have, we sort of sit on this throne of rage. We've got a rage-filled cushion that we sit on and we kind of tap into it when we need it to really, you know, call it because there's a word for it. It's called feminist fatigue. It's where you've just been feminist all day, every day, and it's really, really tiring and nobody thanks you for it. And generally what you'll end up with if you really, you know, make it your job to call things out is being in the situation of, you know, people like Van Badham or Clementine Ford who are just abused on a daily basis, you know, threatened with, you know, rape or you know, being murdered because they are standing up for women and standing up for women's views. And so, like, why would you bring that on yourself? Why? But equally, how could you not? Because, you know, I just want to, you know, just say men behave better. Just behave better. Do better.
Yeah.
Not all men, but that's not the point. You know, definitely some guys, though.
No, definitely. I mean, and, you know, that's the work to be done. And, you know, my friends of color and women of color, just, you know.
Exactly.
Tanara Schneider, an ex-colleague of mine on the podcast a little while ago. And she said, you know, there are times when, obviously, sure, again, it takes the energy to fight that fight. And there are other times when she's just like, don't bring me in to be your representative of this or representative of all women or all people of color. Do your work, do your homework, you know, and do it yourself.
I do find myself being brought into meetings where the stakeholder is a senior woman. So if it's a C-level woman, I'll get tapped on the shoulder by some of my sales colleagues and going, hey, can you take this one? can you come along? It'd be good if you could come and do this. And I'm like, what, you want me to do the lady dance in front of the lady? So that's not how it works. Like I have to have something that person is going to value for me to have a conversation with him or her.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant, my gender, in what I bring to that meeting.
Although the only thing is, I would say there is, you know, maybe there's a, I will come, but you're going to do the work and I'm going to give you feedback on what you did. You know, that could be, if you could be
making an assignment.
Bothered to, basically. But then, you know, that still places a lot of kind of energy on you to do that work and not have the self-reflection.
Yeah, and I think the one that really irritates me the most is when you get told that the way that you are claiming your space or making your point about something that's sexist or, you know, the behavior that's bad, you get asked or told to do it nicer. Otherwise, you know, you won't get anybody to engage with your viewpoint. And I'm like, why should I have to defend my fundamental human rights nicely? Why is that a thing? Why do I have to diminish myself and my voice in order to make you, not you personally, but you, whoever I'm calling out, feel comfortable and okay with being called out and willing to listen to what I've got to say? Why do I have to make myself small so that you can feel okay with that?
So the whole thing of kind of be quiet, don't rock the boat, don't have a voice, or turn your voice down is right. So I'm interested in this because it's an external script. Obviously, it gets socialized to be an internal script for a lot of women in leadership. Men have a kind of different thing, I think, which I think men are driven a lot more by fear and anxiety than any men will give credence to or admit to. But there's it's actually what causes a lot of that kind of bad behavior and some of the aggressive behavior too. You know, and in fact, a lot of the reactions to women standing up, it's a fear reaction as much as anything else. I'm interested in if there was a sort of moment or an experience you've had or what you draw upon to not take on that internalized script, or whether it was there for a while and there was a moment when you thought, no, well, sod this, I'm not going to do this anymore, or if it's something that's grown on you or whether it's always been with you.
I can pinpoint the exact moment. I was living in London. I was working for Sapient at the time. We were working with an English bank on a fairly technical, actually, project. So a lot of the people were from the tech side of it, and also there were the business stakeholders as well from the bank. And I remember being in a meeting. I was running the whole show, like I was running the project. I was running all of the facets that this meeting was actually called about. And I got into the meeting and everybody came in and sat down. And the man from the bank next to me, the people had started discussing things, and he looked at me and he said, oh, you're going to take some minutes? I'm not having this. And this is the first time I can really remember calling it out. And I just said, why? Because I'm the only woman in the room? And it was really satisfying to just watch him like curl up into like something, a slug that I'd put salt on. And I said, I'll take notes for myself, but, you know, I'm not here for the minute taking. I'm here to facilitate this session. This is my job here. And that's the first time I remember like really standing up for myself and going, nah, screw this. I'm not gonna be that, cast in that role, I guess. And ever since then, like I don't do it all the time perfectly, and I didn't fight every battle. I mean, I think in terms of fatigue, you have to choose the hills you're going to die on.
Which
hills are worth dying on? And that's a good leadership tip is also, you know, choose the hills you're going to die on, because sometimes it's not worth it. Sometimes you can't actually have any impact, and then you just might need to just take a rest so you can come back and fight for something that you really, really care about. That was the turning point. That was early 2000s, I guess. So I just turned 30. No, I was late 20s. So it was fairly, you know, late on to develop that.
Well, not necessarily.
My 16-year-old stepdaughter is already better at it than I was at that age.
Well, good for her, you know. No, not particularly, because, you know, I know women who are much older than you are now and will still have that kind of anxiety, I guess, about speaking up, not because they don't see the outrage of it, but because, you know, there's a CLM, the career limiting move, you know, of, you know, that's going to be negatively reflect back upon me. And it does, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I've been called abrasive by my peers, you know, and that was recently, like, and it's by someone who probably thinks he's a good guy and not sexist in any way, shape or form. But yeah, I was called abrasive, and it really hurt.
You know, it's not something we're going to kind of completely unpack. You mentioned age. May I ask how old you are now?
I am 46 and a half. I'll be 47 next year.
I love the way you said that, like a kid. I'm 46 and a half, 46 and three quarters.
I'm pretty excited about getting older. I'm like, I'm fine with it.
I've been talking quite a lot in the sort of podcast recently about the second half of life. You know, there is a kind of shift in those kind of late 30s, late 40s, in that sort of period of time into a different role. And it is common for people to move into a leadership role in that time. So, you know, you were probably one of the, you know, top, there's all these kind of, you know, top 40 under 40 and all of the, or top 30 under 30. I'm looking forward to the you know.
Top 50
top
over
50? Entrepreneurs under, yeah, or something, you know. I feel that kind of youth and entrepreneurship is somewhat fetishized. Having been a, you know, top 10 Australian woman entrepreneur, What are your feelings about that? Not that you're getting old, but you know.
Look, I'm deeply at peace with my age. I have no issues. In fact, I think I just get better. The more that I know, the more I understand my power, and the better I can be at all the things I turn my hand to. So
you're comfortable with who you
are. I'm good with that. I think we do fetishize youth in entrepreneurship. And if you are able to be a successful entrepreneur or just successful as a young person, then it's somehow a minor miracle that's worthy of massive celebration, which, you know, it seems churlish to not want to celebrate people's successes. I'd be very keen, you know, like you are, to see some celebration of someone who was over 65 and kind of thought that they were at the end of their career and then had, you know, a spark and an idea and they were able to spin up a successful business. Now, I think that's also a great story worthy of celebrating. I don't think we shouldn't, you know, not celebrate one at the expense of the other. I think there's plenty of room to celebrate all, but I think one definitely does get a lot more attention because, you know, as a society, I mean, if we can get really, you know, psychological, we fetishize youth in general.
Yeah, we do.
Youth and beauty and all of that is absolutely, you know, aspirational and what we all want to be. You know, people, you know, not you and me because we don't care. We're happy to get old, but, you know.
You're saying I'm not youthful and beautiful anymore.
You are youthful and beautiful. you have a fine face of hair.
Grey hair.
No, it's all right. I am in the same boat. It's just that I'm not willing to give it up yet and will continue to.
I tell you, I'm not going to dye my beard, that's for sure.
That's like next level weird.
Skin colored.
But it's true. We do. We fetishize youth or in general and also absolutely in business and entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
I think there's only certain places where grey hair is appreciated and it's usually only ever male grey hair. Women, you know, female grey hair is not appreciated anywhere. And I, you know, I don't fight that fight at all. I can't be bothered. It's not important. But I would like to see the story of the person who thought that they were at the end of their career and they spun up a business. And let's celebrate a list of top 10 of those.
Yeah. I mean, in many respects, it's a lot harder to do when you're in your 50s because you've got all the established responsibilities of kind of, you know, family and mortgage and all the rest of it. In a way, you don't have much to lose in your 20s.
Yeah, it's harder to take the risk.
You eat a lot of pot noodles, but otherwise you kind of, you know, and live in a kind of cheaper rented shared apartment. I mean, risk is definitely a kind of adventure often for the youth, but I think it's a thing that, as you get older, you get a little bit more scared of, to a detriment, actually. I think it's one of the kind of things that people gets people stuck in that second half of life is you know, they don't feel like they want to take the risk anymore.
Yeah, I can understand that, but also I'm not that person either. I will try anything and see what works.
I'll interview you in 20 years' time and we'll see.
Okay. Deal.
So listen, we're coming up for time. First of all, as you know, the podcast is named after this Ray and Charles Eames film, Powers of Ten, about the relative size of things in the universe. So the final question is, what small thing, either something that's overlooked or something that could do with being redesigned, would make an outsized effect on the world?
How far back in history can I go?
Well, it should be something that is kind of could be redesigned or is still relevant now, put it that way.
I think the fundamental premise of social media is something that should have been redesigned or at least in its outset, anybody thinking about the unintended consequences of the change. Let's go for a neutral word, the change that it has brought about to our society, our social interactions, our understanding of truth, our democracies, and I really feel like there was a moment in time in the generation of social media and particularly in the monetization of the data that is collected in social media where there could have been a better conversation about unintended consequences and different design directions taken. That would be my thing that we could have done better and would have had a remarkable effect.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree. We haven't even talked about design and AI and all those things, but not enough red teaming of ideas and concepts of, you know, how could this be abused and how could we hack this? How might this get out of control?
I feel like the next one's coming and there's this moment in time, which is Elon Musk and his Neuralink project that he's working on, where, you know, he's talking about downloading memories into like a robotic self and, you know, being able to write to the brain and this whole brain interface. And I feel like there's, well, I know for a fact, because I watched the press release from end to end, there was nobody there talking about ethics. And just because we can, does it mean we should? There was nobody there when they asked the question about what's the most important problem that Neuralink has to solve to realize its true potential. The answer to that was we need to find the right thin wires to stick into the brain. Nothing about ethics or the ethical minefield that's laying around that project. And I really am deeply concerned that we're at an inflection point similar to where we were when Mark Zuckerberg decided, you know, he wanted to create something so he could figure out who at his university was, you know, single or not. We're at an inflection point where somebody's got to be asking those questions. Otherwise, I feel like we're going to have another, in 10 years' time, another set of unintended consequences and end up with biological inequalities and, you know, all sorts of things.
Yeah. Desirable, viable and feasible needs and ethical on there as well. Although I would argue that it's that should be under the desirable thing, really.
Well, we could have another whole podcast about that. we just don't have time.
We'll save it for another time. Talking of social media, so where can people find you online?
I am findable, obviously, on LinkedIn, and that is an easy way to get a hold of me. I'm also findable on Twitter as LuckyKat, LuckyKat. And I'm also on Instagram, first name, last name. Easy to find.
I'll put some links to it in the show notes.
Oh, cool.
Katya, thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
You're so very welcome. Thank you for having me.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.